This is the Four.
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 Golfers Network Podcast, where we celebrate the greatest game on earth.
Who wants to have some fun?
Your host has been known to spend so much time in the sand, he brings along a chair, shovel, and sunblock. Yes, you can play through. Here's Bill Hobson.
Oh, wow! In your life, have you seen anything like that?
Hello and welcome into the Four Golfers Network Podcast. I'm Bill Hobson. Thank you for listening, for downloading, and for sharing this program with other golfers in your world, even though it's the middle of November. And for many of us, that means golf season is sort of in a hiatus until we get to the blooming of the azaleas and the playing of the piano music at the Masters next April. Now, hopefully, you've got a couple of road trips scheduled between now and then so you can get away, get some swings in and get warm, put some shorts on, have some sunburn, and all those things that help you escape winter. But as we sit here today outside of my studio, it's not very nice. And so I thought what we would do today is focus on those nicer times of year and share with you an interview I recorded a few weeks back with the gentleman who was runner-up at the 1982 Masters. That was the year that Craig Stadler claimed his green jacket. Did you remember that Dan Pohl came in second? Well, Dan now is a golf course owner in the middle of Michigan at a beautiful property called the Pohl Cat, a course he also designed. And we're going to talk with Dan about all sorts of things, his career, the state of the game, what it's like to be a golf course owner, and a whole lot more. And then we bring onto the program my friend Brian Weiss from golftrips.com to talk about some potential golf getaway places for you between now and the end of the year. We'll get started with Dan Pohl and then our road trip segment in just a couple of seconds. But first, would you please go into iTunes and consider giving the Four Golfers Network podcast a 5-star rating? That helps us turn up a little bit higher in those search results when people are looking for their golf fix in the form of podcasts. And these days, there are a million, I think, golf podcasts. So if you don't mind, going into iTunes and giving us a kind rating would be very helpful. Okay, we get things started with Dan Pohl in about 60 seconds. All right, I've got to take 60 seconds to save you a ton of money. Believe me, you'll thank me later. I recently joined Select, a next-generation Black Card concierge and membership community offering exclusive and unlimited benefits with premier brands worldwide. Now, we're talking up to 70% off at 500,000-plus hotels and resorts. Up to 40% off the full bill and free beverages for your entire party at globally renowned restaurants. Discounts with hundreds of premier travel and lifestyle brands, including Bose, Brooks Brothers, Cole Haan, Royal Caribbean, and many more. All you need to do is apply for membership today at meetselect.com, and see why the Select card is being called Amex for the next generation by national publications. Now, when you sign up, use promo code GOLF to save $50 on your Select membership. It's already a fantastic deal and just got even better when you use promo code GOLF. Select more than lives up to the hype and will save you a boatload of dough as you enjoy the finer places and things in life. Visit meetselect.com right now and be sure to use promo code GOLF. This is a unique privilege and opportunity for me to share with all of you across the country a conversation with, man, a guy who's been a friend of mine for a good number of years. I might have had some hair when Dan Pohl and I first met. And we're chatting on the patio of his golf course in Mount Pleasant, Michigan, right in the heart of the state. The course is called the Pohl Cat. Back in 1992, they had a ribbon-cutting ceremony. And I think even cooler, or just as cool, is that you designed this place. This was your first course architectural build.
Yeah, this was one that, I'd known a little bit about the property just from, obviously being here in Mount Pleasant, but really never walked it to a tight, layout type atmosphere. And when the Brehm family, Bill Brehm specifically, asked me to get involved with the possibility of, putting my name on a golf course and being my hometown. And, you threw a lot of you're kind of going around going, okay, well, is this something I want to do? Do I know enough about it? But I had, when you play the tour and you play so many great golf courses, so many different styles of golf courses, and you kind of get a feel for what you like. And this particular piece offered a lot. I mean, it had a lot of restrictions to it, working with the DNR on wetlands and the Chippewa River running through it and creating an atmosphere that, you know, kind of blended, you know, a variety of looks rather than just being a wooded area golf course or an open area golf course. I really made the effort, I thought, at the time to give that variety of looks, and I think I accomplished it.
I'm trying to remember my timelines accurately, but back in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, I don't recall distance being as often or as frequent a topic of discussion as it is now. Technology hadn't literally exploded to where it is now. I think we were right around the time of the TaylorMade burner bubble, and I just saw one in somebody's hands a few weeks ago, and I thought, man, that belongs in the Hall of Fame. When you designed this course, was distance or future technology even a factor?
No, not really, because I don't think you know, hitting great short irons and great mid irons has anything to do with technology. Has to do with your ability to feel a distance and to create spin, and that that to me covers all areas and all ages and things. As far as the shots I hit in the 80s, I still hit today.
Okay.
Whether the club and the ball has changed a little bit, I'm a field player. I play with a different mentality. A lot of times when I go around this golf course, I don't take yardages. I see distances. I like to play by more, you know, how's my body reacting to the feel. And when I can actually go out and play any golf course with no yardage and get the distance control on, then I know I'm playing pretty well. And that's what I think is a challenge for most people, is not really, you know, and I tell people this really is an iron player's golf course. I mean, what I was trying to build was an area that you had a few tight driving holes, 7 and 8, some of there, but really, reality-wise, this is fairly wide open.
Yeah.
You know, for most people, they don't. But coming into the greens was the real, in understanding that I was a really good iron player of my era,
right,
and really felt like that was probably my strength.
You know,
that's what I was trying to accomplish.
What blows me away, Dan, about the players of your era, especially yourself, is that you were a great iron player when irons had no sweet spots. I mean, they were the size of a nickel, and now they're much more forgiving. Mm-hmm. The technology has come quite a ways. If you're starting over today, if Dan Pohl's 19 years old, how much different would you be as a player? You were pretty long in your day.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you would have focused on differently?
Well, I don't think you would. You know, it's pretty hard to imagine yourself, you know, changing eras and doing that. I think if you've heard from Byron Nelson and players like that, you know, if you're a champion and you're a good player, you're going to be a good player
no matter what.
You know, whether people would ask him, well, you think you'd hit the ball any better? Well, you know, the ball's only a certain size. If you can hit that center spot, and I think the club that I have in the Hall of Fame has got a center worn right out of it.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
What club was it?
It's a pitching wedge.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I took a lot of pitching wedges to their deaths. You know, and when I say that, I wore the center of it out because I used a pitching wedge kind of like guys do gap wedges and 56-degree wedges of today.
The same wedge.
Same wedge. I used it with, you know, open face, square face, closed, and I created different shots. And I never hit my short irons hard.
Yeah.
But I hit them, you know, I practiced with them for distance control. So it wasn't unusual for me, Bill, from 85 yards out to hit a wedge and take a little bit off of it and really feel like I could control it.
Do you still do it that way?
I do it, yeah. I don't hit my short irons hard. I tell people, I said, when I'm teaching or when I'm showing people, I said, I played about 85% of my power with my irons.
Yeah.
And that way I had 15% that I could go to. I think there's talk about the old Michigan amateur when I was on the 18th hole and hit it over that big tree on the left of number 18 with a 9-iron from 160 yards out. Yeah. Well, I wouldn't have been able to get an 8-iron up over that tree. But when you've got that ability to reach back and grab a little bit more speed and distance, that's a kind of an unknown, because most people, they maximize their speed. If you say, what do you hit a 7-iron, and they
give you the top end.
Top end. So they have no mishit. You know, when they mishit, it's they don't have that extra thing. I figure if I hit an 8-iron 160 yards, let's just say, and it's at 85% of my power, I still got 15%.
If you need it, you can get it.
So now I've got another, 9, 10 yards that I could get if necessary.
One of the most beneficial things I think that I did selfishly for my own game this season, I helped coach a high school team. And I would go out with the guys when we could get on the course, and I would just take a 6-iron and my 54, and I'd play 9 holes with them. Well, we're playing short courses, so I don't want anybody to think that I'm not a long hitter. But it forced me to learn how to do multiple things with just those two clubs. And I actually enjoy putting with my wedge. It's really pretty good training. So I kind of get the idea of the versatility, but I'm also curious about what it was like when it was time to trade out a club, when you truly did wear everything off of the face of the wedge. Because from what I gather from professional players, from tour players, these clubs are your children. And yeah, you're going to wear them out, and you know you have to replace them, but is it hard to get the feel for the next one to come into the bag?
Well, I don't think in our era it was that wasn't that difficult. And I just want to back up just a little bit. And you come from, you know, close to when I was there. And, you know, we used to have 3, 5, 7, 9 iron. We didn't even have even number of clubs. I mean, so when you had a set that was first.
Wait, you didn't have 2, 4, 6,
well, no,
eight?
No, when I was playing high school golf, I didn't have even number of clubs. I had a 3, 5, 7, 9 iron.
Interesting. I did not know
sand
that.
Sand wedges were obsolete for us. We might have one that was a 56, the old first PGA one that came in that was at 56 degree, and everybody, ooh, man, I got a sand wedge. So from my standpoint, I made use of that, and I challenge individuals a lot of times to say, okay, if you think this is an 8-iron, hit a 7, and see if you can get the distance.
Yeah.
Now, from the standpoint moving on and saying, how do I get another club that matches that. What's happening in manufacturing now, which wasn't happening then, is that we didn't have all the choices. You know, we were with companies that came out with, you know, one club selection or two, and you picked which one, and you could pretty much depend on the next set being very similar to the other one.
Okay.
Now, you know, there's a turnover. You know, whether it's TaylorMade, whether it's Mizuno, wherever it is, there's 5 or 6 different styles of clubs, and every 6 months they're coming out with the new and better. And I've always believed that until they come out with something with a plutonium insert or something, what is considered better? What is, the sweet spot is a very delicate area for most people. But if you learn to hit it, you maximize efficiency and maximize power through that. And so, you know, mishits are, instead of being out in the woods, they might be in the bunker or whatever. But I don't like the fact that the average player is not having to really concentrate on a good mechanically sound golf swing, because they're giving them this ability to mishit shots all over. What other sport do you play where you get such a variety? You know, if you put a soccer ball down, do they have one where if you kick it in the left side of it, it's right, better than if you miss it, to the right? I don't know. Does a baseball have, if I hit it on the top, it goes further? I've never heard of any other sport that kind of pushes the fact that let's make it easier. Let's make it more, beneficial to hit it out on the toe versus the heel. Now, you played, again, when I was driving the ball long ways back in the day, the driver was 43 1/4 inches long, and it maximized the center of the wooden head. Now you see these guys hit it out on the toe, out on the heel. So I don't believe that guys hit it that much further when they hit it solidly versus what we did. They hit it further because it's forgiving in so many different areas of the head. And that's the one thing that I tell people. I said, my driver, I hit it solid. I mean, I hit it in the middle of the face.
All right, I've got to take 60 seconds to save you a ton of money. Believe me, you'll thank me later. I recently joined Select, a next-generation Black Card concierge and membership community offering exclusive and unlimited benefits with premier brands worldwide. Now, we're talking up to 70% off at 500,000-plus hotels and resorts. Up to 40% off the full bill and free beverages for your entire party at globally renowned restaurants. Discounts with hundreds of premier travel and lifestyle brands, including Bose, Brooks Brothers, Cole Haan, Royal Caribbean, and many more. All you need to do is apply for membership today at meetselect.com, and see why the Select card is being called Amex for the next generation by national publications. Now, when you sign up, use promo code GOLF to save $50 on your Select membership.
It's already a fantastic deal and just got even better when you use promo code GOLF. Select more than lives up to the hype and will save you a boatload of dough as you enjoy the finer places and things in life. Visit meetselect.com right now and be sure to use promo code GOLF. There are so many golf podcasts on the market these days, it's almost like a double stack, double shotgun charity outing where you know it's going to take all day to sort through and find the winner. We would love to have your help rising up in the search results when people are looking for golf podcasts. So if you don't mind, please go into iTunes and give us a 5-star rating for the Four Golfers Network podcast. It would mean a lot. It would help a lot. And the whole process is way quicker than a 6-hour round.
I'm interested in your contemporaries. Let's go back here. Mm-hmm. Many of them came to the grand opening of the Polecat back in 1992. But let me throw some names at you and just give me a really quick impression what you remember most about maybe their game or just their personalities. Mm-hmm. I may have some of the names from the wrong era, but I think I'm pretty good here. Greg Norman.
One of the best ball strikers, the best driver of the golf ball I ever played with in my era from length and playability standpoints. Unafraid of anything, aggressive. He didn't get the moniker of, the shark and how the attack and stuff by accident. He has the type of game that he's not afraid to hit the shot when necessary, and bottom line is that's what makes you a great champion. Now, with the majors, you made some mistakes, maybe being aggressive, and that's what you pay for that that position that you're in. But great guy from my standpoint on the golf course and off, because we were both aggressive players. We both understood ourselves off the golf courses, and hopefully consider him, I hope he considers me a good friend to this day.
I have heard time and time again that maybe the purest striker of the ball for a very long time was Nick Price. Did you think so?
In a different mentality, speed to speed. I mean,
Nick, what do you mean by that?
Well, they talk about slow takeaways. They talk about, setting the rhythm up with a very methodical slow takeaway, and Nick was fast to fast. His rhythm was totally different than the other players. Now, again, when you have a fast to fast rhythm, when you're on, you're going to be pure. I mean, you're going to stripe it. When you're off a little bit and you might get your hips out in front or your legs out in front, that's when you kind of don't have that same quality as a ball striker. But Nick had a very similar, I talk about guys that, how do you compare Freddie Couples and Ernie Els and them to Nick Price? You can't, because they're slow to a faster motion. Nick, speed to speed, loved the action. Again, one of the nicest guys you'll ever want to meet on and off the golf course, and really one of those true Hall of Famers that you respect.
Freddie Couples.
That lazy, kind of doesn't care attitude is complete bull.
Is it?
Oh. Well, I mean, when I say that, he's got a fire deep inside of him that burns on a different level. Because when you're so talented like he is, like Weisskopf, like guys like that, that have so many ways to play a golf course and to take a golf course apart. I mean, there's always a thought that, a Corey Pavin, does he get along and play like a Freddie Couples? No. They have different ways that they got to work their way around a golf course. Freddie and guys like, Ernie and guys like that look like that soft motion and that fluidity, have that inside power that it's very difficult to teach or to even find. But what I loved about Freddie was his ability to take that free attitude and parlay that into a personality off the golf course that people really loved.
Right.
And you can talk about all the great players of the game, but I think when people talk about Freddie, I don't think they talk as much about his Masters win and all the great finishes. They talk about what a loving type of guy he is and has that type of attitude that a lot of people would love to have.
And yet a guy that's gone through a lot of personal pain. I mean, he's lost a wife to suicide. Mm-hmm. He's had a lot of things that have happened in his life, and yet you're right. He's still as beloved as can be. And, in fact, later this season, when the Champions Tour comes back to Michigan to Warwick Hills, I would anticipate, if his health allows, that Freddie would be in the field and probably will be one of the most popular players in the field.
And again, you they – you don't overstate or blame back problems. It's part of the equation as you get older, and he's had it. But with Freddie, he's able to, you know, get away from the game, and I couldn't tell you exactly what he does all the time in his free time.
I'm not sure he does
anything. But all of a sudden, he comes back, and he's right at the top. You know, you don't go to Augusta National and make the cut without some quality of play. You know, I mean, I know he's physically limited on practicing and those things, but for him, I think it's just a natural to get almost like an adrenaline rush where he pushes himself past that pain or that mentality, and he's able to establish a different rapport mentally when he's at Augusta.
It's kind of become one of the new rites of spring, and that is Freddie goes to Augusta for 2 days, has everybody thinking, hey, maybe this could be the miracle, and then, you know, the gas tank runs a little bit empty. And you've been at Augusta. You've had some career defining moments at Augusta. When you first think about entering, driving down Magnolia Lane, what are the flashback memories in the mind of Dan Pohl?
Well, I mean, and I tell people it's a little different for a mid-Michigan, northern mentality. You know, we knew of Augusta. We saw it. I was a baseball player.
We dreamed of it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, Magnolia Lane to a kid that's from Augusta, Georgia, or from the South is going to be a little different, I think, than a guy from the middle of Michigan.
Yeah.
A transcending moment. I mean, when you hear it and you first know that you're in it, you're always wondering what's it going to be like.
The ringtone on my phone is the Masters theme.
Is it really?
Yeah. Because that's what we dream about, especially all winter long.
Yeah, you know, but I think in my situation, you know, I grew up more probably pushing towards a baseball mentality than I did golf for a long time. So I wasn't really, at age 10, 12, 15, I wasn't watching the Augusta with the theme that I'm going to be there.
Okay.
You know, and I'm going to play.
It wasn't your driving motivation.
It wasn't at all. I mean, my motivation was to be the best I could be in the golf season, the basketball season, and the baseball season, and see how the next month or 2 months. It wasn't like at 15 I was dreaming of making the putt, you know, to win the Masters.
Okay.
Because there was almost too much stuff going on, and I loved the transitional time of, you know, of the three-sport rotation. And I think, you know, if kids nowadays could reevaluate the idea of just playing one sport and not having be 100% taken by it all the time, I think you'd see a better mix of individual, you know, as far as the kids go. But whether you're a baseball player and the coach says, no, you can't play any other sport. Well, I used to play an 18-hole round of golf and then do a double hitter, and it never affected my batting or anything else.
Yeah.
So I think what I'm trying to get across is that from the standpoint of the Masters, yes, huge once you knew you were going and stuff. Was it driven and thought through during my earlier years? Probably not.
How many times did you compete?
I played 7 times there. Obviously, the first time I lost in the playoffs, so that was, you know, talked about all the time. It's amazing now that it was, 36 years ago or something like that, 1982. You think back of some of the, you know, one shot here or there, but, you know, that's given. The next year I played well, finished 8th, and I was able to, you know, enjoy the – I'll tell you what the enjoyment of the Masters was for me. At the time, John Mahaffey, Hubert Green, who passed away here recently, and Fuzzy Zeller and I were all on the Max Fly staff together. We played practice rounds together. We played the par 3 contest together. Hmm. Those moments of being around that facility, especially Fuzzy having won it in 79, his first time out, was probably the things that I remember more than the actual shots during the week.
Yeah.
You know, if you said, okay, you know, what did you do on Thursday or Friday or Saturday? I can pull back on Saturday where I went birdie, or eagle, birdie on 13, 14, 15, and 16. It's still a record today, and it's always brought up. But could I tell you the first tee shot? Could I tell you what happened on 7 on Friday? What I could tell you is during the par 3 contest, Fuzzy would give away every golf ball in your bag.
Is that right?
He'd give away every tee, glove, whatever. And when you got done, you know, it was almost like his way of releasing any tension and having the enjoyment of the Masters also was through the connection from the people and basically that those are the memories that you can't put a price tag on or pull back on and forget.
Well, I want you to take us to the competitive juices flowing moments, and here's why I ask the question. In 2016, my son and I were there on Thursday, and of course we got there super early in the morning. And we made our way around to the first tee right when the first tee shot was about to be struck. And we weaseled our way right up onto the ropes, and we were right there. And Jim Herman was the first player to hit a tee shot in the 2016 Masters because he had just qualified the week prior by winning in Houston. So last in, first out. And there's that pregnant pause when you know the moment is coming. And my son, Bo, at that time was 18, and he kind of leaned over to me and he says, I have goosebumps. And I said, well, so do I. This is incredible. And then we were close enough to Herman. We were a little closer than you and I are right now. And I heard him say to his caddy, we're really going to do this, aren't we? And then he hit a perfect tee shot. And as soon as that ball landed in the fairway, which, you know, one fairway is not an easy one to hit. As soon as it landed dead center in the fairway, he let out the deepest exhale of relief. And everybody kind of chuckled along with him. He's like, I'm glad that's done with. Yeah. Because that place does something to you. What did it do to you?
You know, the tee shot probably is not as difficult as putting the tee in the ground. That is the most thing, because you're just hoping that the ball stays on the tee. After you get that on the tee, you're pretty much going back to all the practice and all the shots that you've hit.
Now, your hand is a little shaky. Is that what you're saying?
It's still a tough one. But I'll tell you where Augusta gets you, and most people will tell you this, is when you walk out the back of the locker room. And when you walk in the big, you know, you see the magnolia tree, you see the ambiance as you come out the back of the clubhouse.
It's not real, is it?
It's unbelievable. Yeah. You know, so then you knew. I mean, you can get in the club, you know, hit range balls, you can do all that. You can, know that you're going to be out there playing. The playing portion of it was your sanctuary. It's the ambiance and you get nervous, but because you know that any shot could be 2, 3, 4 yards off and can lead to a double bogey awful quick.
Yeah.
Now, again, being a really good iron player at the time, I was able to play Augusta with a left-to-right tee shot, play away from some trouble on 9 and some of the holes that were dogleg 2. And still, because of my distance control with my irons, I was putting it in great spots. I mean, all week long, I had pretty good control of that. When you're really juiced up and you're really nervous, you lose that. That's going to be the determining portion of whether you see somebody's nervous, not really whether they miss it left or right.
Yeah.
It's whether they miss it long and short.
Okay, so when nerves kick in, things change. Distance control changes because there's a chemical called adrenaline that's a part of your equation. So when I think of that Jim Herman moment that I described, I realize that he was one of 100 or so players that were about to have that same moment. But when you get to a playoff, there's just two of you.
Mm-hmm.
So now the spotlight is like a magnifying glass on the ant at the picnic. You know, it's going to fry you up here if you're not careful. How long did you have to wait? I can't remember the order of finish. Did you have a long time to sit around and wonder if you were going to be in a playoff, or did you go right from 18 to the playoff?
No, that's a very good question. I was about an hour out in front and, had really kind of – I'd shot 34 or 33 on the front nine, and Stads had shot 33 also. So going into the back nine, he still had a pretty good lead on everybody.
Okay.
I came in, shot 34, and looked like, you're going to be playing, because we were kind of, you could see on the board, you were kind of jockeying for positions with Ballesteros and Kite and all these guys.
Where were you watching?
Potential runner. Oh, they got the huge boards up there, and I was always a watcher.
You stayed inside or you came outside?
Oh, afterwards?
Yeah.
Oh, no, after I got done playing, I sat with my parents and my brothers and stuff on the putting green and just kind of was just saying, man, I just shot 67 on the weekend.
Wow.
At the Masters. I shot a great front nine. I controlled myself on the back nine. That was really cool. But never until about 14, when he started slipping and going down, did the idea that the back nine of the Masters is where it happens.
Yeah.
And then he was still had a one-shot lead, Craig did, coming up 18, and he knocked it on the green, but the pin was back up into the top right, and he was down on the lower tier. You could hear the ooze.
Well, the pin was back right there
back, yeah,
on
yeah,
Sunday.
It was on the back part of the green. It didn't. I don't think until later on did they start putting it on the front left.
Okay.
He was in the back, and he ended up three putting, and it was kind of like, oh, gosh, I'm in a playoff. I probably made a – that would, if I thought about it now, I probably made a big mistake.
You would have gone to hit balls.
I would have gone just away from the area. I mean, it was kind of almost like, you know, you were wrapped in sitting on the putting green, which was much smaller at that point
yeah,
in time.
Yeah, but close to 18.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden he finishes, and I should have had the advantage. When you think about it, he just had bogeyed 18. He had shot 40 on the back nine or whatever, and his momentum was going the other direction.
Yeah.
The problem was is that number 10 probably didn't fit either one of ours eye off a tee because we were both cutters. We both hit three woods down there in a good spot, both had six irons to the green. He kind of hit his heavy shot, but he kept it below the hole. I just leaked it a little bit right and was on the right on the cusp of the edge of the green, but it was the toughest place that you could put it. You know, people ask me about the putts and that, and I said, no, you know what cost me the Masters potentially, you still would have had to probably par and go on, was the second shot. Yeah, it was a six iron that probably 9 out of 10 times, 8 out of 10 times, you're probably going to hit a good shot down 20 feet below the hole or whatever and have a chance. When I missed it where I did, I didn't recognize how difficult it was, and the only consoling thing about the whole thing was that people came up to me afterwards and said nobody had two-putted from that position all day. So it was in that back right corner on the slope on kind of a ridge, but I was putting over a little area that if you hit it a little bit to the right, it went right, a little bit left and slower, it went left. And so I didn't hit a very good second putt, but I knew that he had already made par. He had put it up there and tapped in. And so, you know, you think about it, a lot of things go through your mind. But the experience, of playing the way I did on the weekend, playing in your first Masters, you're always thinking, man, this golf course, if I can play it like this the first time,
wait until next time.
Oh, boy, wait until I get back.
It doesn't work that way,
does it?
No,
you got to take advantage of it while you can.
For the next few seconds, I hope you'll allow me permission to talk with you about something other than golf, real life, marriage. You see, off the course and back home where real life happens, things can sometimes get a bit bumpy. Whether the tension is caused by the amount of time you spend on the course or perhaps something far more serious, I know this. Most every married couple would readily welcome a healthier partnership during these happily ever after years together. For those reasons, I host another podcast called Marriage Talk. Every Friday, we release a new episode where a 20-plus year licensed counselor and therapist addresses questions, concerns, and issues sent in by our listeners. You'll find Marriage Talk on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and our entire 2-year archive of programs is available for free at marriagetalk.org. Deep down, we know there's more to life than birdies and bogeys, especially when it comes to the relationship with your soulmate. So I hope you'll give the Marriage Talk podcast a try and see how it can help your game away from the course. Subscribe today to the Marriage Talk podcast.
When I think of a player waiting for a playoff, or we're just waiting to find out if he needed to stick around or not, I think of it all in today's setting. So I'm picturing you in an air-conditioned locker room watching on a flat panel TV. Well, 1982 is a different world. I'm not even sure the scoring area was inside in 1982. You may have done it at a table out near the putting green and then naturally stayed in the area. So you're not having a sandwich. You're not kicking back. You're just hanging out, and then all of a sudden, you kind of get blindsided by this reality, right?
Yeah. You know, the big board on 18 has always been there, so you got a feel for where you're going. So you're other than that, there wasn't a lot of areas where you could actually see what the action was. No, they didn't have, and that was an era too that they really only televised the back nine. So even on the front nine, you didn't know exactly what was going on. So you know, it's hard to compare today's world of golf into there. You know, in how you prep and see these guys, going to the bathroom before they go out and play. I mean, there's a lot of cool things that are happening in the game.
Some of it's too much.
Yeah, from the player standpoint, how much is too much? How watching a complete practice session, 2 hours or 3 hours behind, what does that do for a player? I think a playoff now, you know, and they're doing a lot of better job of kind of making it a two or three hole deal.
Yeah.
I still believe the Masters is a sudden death type thing. And, you know, obviously, you know, I think back of April in 82, but only with fond memories,
good.
Not with anything negative. Yeah.
What an awesome accomplishment. And have you been back there? When's the last time you played Augusta?
A long time. In fact, I was looking to try to get in there and do it here within the next couple of years, but it's not a place that you just go and play when you got other things going on.
Right.
And I want to go back and just take in a few of the, you know, some of the changes and look and see, you know, where it's at. You go to that top of the hill on number 11 again, go to, you know, the ninth hole down in the edge of the right rough where I used to hit it every time. You know, the left side was pretty much dormant for me.
Was there rough in 82?
Very thin.
Yeah.
The holes that I think, you know, they made, you know, change dramatically overall was like a hole like 7. 7 was just a fantastic short hole. You know, we hit 2 irons or 3 irons, had that sandwich in your hand, and you had to control the spin so much. Now these guys are forced to hit not only a longer club, but if they do lay back, I'm not sure that green was set up to make hit 7 irons and, you know, 8 irons too. It's just one of those great short holes that you wonder, okay, could you have left it the same, and see that spin control, those wedges, you know, really be important. 12 is always going to be what it is. It doesn't have to get longer. It doesn't have to get shorter to be that great hole. But I definitely want to get back. I don't know if going back with all the televisions and all the things that are there and just walking, it would give me the same excitement as walking the fairways again.
Okay. So that moment was one of many back in the 82 range. Now in 92, when you cut the ribbon here at the Polecat in Mount Pleasant, you had a pretty good Hall of Fame lineup of friends and colleagues that came to be part of that. What do you remember about that day?
Oh, just kind of all just blend together as one, you know, long, fun, you know, atmosphere. I mean, at the time, the year before, I'd played with Dan Marino in the AT&T or the old Crosby, won it with him as a partner.
Did you really?
Yes. Yeah,
the old Clambake.
Yeah, the old, you know, Crosby Clambake. Played with him, and Don Strock was actually his backup quarterback at Miami and had played in the event also. So, you know, those two coming on board. Dan Marley, at the time, you know, CMU guy, I was playing a lot of golf with him out in Phoenix. And just one of the nicest guys you want to meet. But then you put into the equation Dave Stockton and Freddie Couples, and Freddie had come off winning the Masters, you know, in that year.
Wow.
And was only a month removed from winning in April, and we're opening up in May 26. So to get him on board through a friendship, number one, but also Lynn Roach at the time was both of our management group, and Stockton was part of that group too. So when Dave come on board, and then eventually was the Ryder Cup captain, and it was just a perfect fit for the day. It was a combination of old and new and athletes, and you know, you were talking football, you're talking basketball, you had people, you know, from all areas of sport, along with bringing in, you know, radio and television and really promoting what we thought at the time was just something unique to the central part of Michigan.
Yeah, and it was.
And it was, exactly. But to then have, you know, when you walk into the Polecat now and you can reminisce of 1992 and you see the bag signed by all of them, you got pictures of those guys up on the front area there. That just, every time I drive up here, and I did a little video, Bill, coming down Airport Road and turning in, and I said, you know, a lot of people talk about Magnolia Lane and the excitement and everything else. Every time I make the turn into the Polecat is my Magnolia Lane.
Very cool.
It's the opportunity to me to leave something that is, you know, has my name on it, that has my guts in it, my sweat in it, and my passion in it.
And your name on it.
Exactly. And so when I drive in there and see what I want to see and then have people come and experience what I really feel is truly a very good golf course, that's something I'm very proud of.
You've been very good for the game. The game has been very good to you. Do you have any golf-related regrets?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think back, and I appreciate those. I hope I've been good for the game. And, you know, from the standpoint of how I And I tell people, I said, when you're playing professionally, you have to be a little selfish. You got to be a little arrogant. You got to have an edge to you because it's a tough.
Teammates out there.
Yeah, exactly. I really feel like I'm a nicer guy now. And as Hale Irwin and some of those guys that opened up later in their careers.
Stadler.
Well, yeah, once they're older and they understand what they've been. But I hope people understand that when you're in the process of being, at a high level of any sport, you have to have a little bit of edge to you. But
were you a jerk back then?
Yeah, sometimes.
Really?
Yeah, because you're focused on a lot of things. You know, there's nothing worse from the standpoint of a tour professional that comes off of a green and he's just made double bogey and somebody wants to be nice and they say, hey, you know, I'm a friend of your uncle's aunt or something.
You don't
and you're kind of going, you know, nice timing, you know, so a lot of things are about
sign
timing
my hat,
in there.
Sign
yeah,
my glove.
Exactly. So you get that mentality. From the standpoint of, what golf has given to me, it's given me stories. It's given me the opportunity to talk. You know, and I tell people, I said, man, I got some, you know, some times when I played with Jack Lemmon and Arthur Ashe and Randy Quaid and Clint Eastwood and Peter Uberoff and guys outside of their golf element. And then along with sitting on the dais after winning at Colonial to be able to have Ben Hogan down on the end of it, Byron Nelson out in the audience.
That's crazy.
Sitting with Byron Nelson talking about different things. How could you to not understand that it was pretty, pretty interesting life and to meet all the odd people that love this game. Joe Pesci, I interviewed, I worked, Sean Connery. I interviewed Sean Connery when I was working with NBC. So, you know, and then that's just the outside edges. Now you talk about all the great business people and all the connections that you've got over the years. Been pretty lucky. And so, like I said, the golf, for most people, it's what signifies what your career was like. I like to think that what we're doing now and with the way people connect with you as an individual, and that's what did Arnold. I mean, as much as Arnold was revered as the player, as the man, he was much. You know, I mean, that's when you looked at Arnold, you knew he was there.
What is your lasting, defining, top of mind Arnold moment that makes you think of him every time somebody brings up his name?
I played with Arnold twice, and actually I've got some pictures in there of him playing with him at the Bay Hill Invitational, or it used to be Arnold Tomlin Invitational, Nestle, you know, they've had a lot of different, but Arnold had a knack of the first time he played with you to get in your golf bag and pull out your sticks and wiggle them like they were his and check and see what you were using. He was a golf club nut.
Yeah,
and
had thousands of them.
But he wanted to know what other people were playing and how they looked at it. So there was I can't forget this. We were playing, it was the 17th hole at the Bay Hill, and he took out one of my irons, and I looked over, and he's like this, just as calm, like it was just something that he did every day. He loved the game so much, and he had such a passion, and having a chance to be close to Payne Stewart and some guys that lived at Bay Hill and that knew him even, you know, a lot better than I did. I knew him on the fact that what he did, you know, for golf and playing with him and stuff, but these guys knew him personally, and you know, just listening to them and knowing the passion he had for the game, I don't think there'll ever be anybody that has that same, you know, take to him.
Do you think he knew what his impact was? I mean, he didn't act like it, but do you think that he knew back then I don't know at what point he thought of himself as the king. We all did. But it maybe one of his enduring charms was that he never acted like it.
It would be hard, I would guess, to know that you don't have that impact.
Right.
I mean, I don't know how you could be, you know, have so many accolades and have so many people appreciate you in the game, both on and off, and what he did for, you know, the children of the Orlando and across the world.
Yeah.
I don't know how you wouldn't know that, but as you stated, he didn't show that.
Yeah.
And I think it was just part of his DNA growing up the way he did and having such a father figure and somebody that just, you know, kind of set him on the right path. And I think that's where I was very fortunate too. My dad is 92 now and he's still alive, and mom's 91, and I get to see him every day, and
awesome.
You know, we get to, you know, kind of, you know, reminisce on some of these things because they were at Bay Hill. They're at the Masters. They're at Disney World. They're at Torrey Pines. They're at Pebble Beach. Got to see all these places, Muirfield for the Ryder Cup. And I you know, thank my lucky stars that, you know, I had a family that had that same, you know, that showed the passion that I did.
We're all just little boys when it comes back down to it.
Still am in my mom's eyes. At 63, she's still saying, Danny, you're my little boy. You take care. You know, what are you doing today? And so it's an interesting time in all of our lives. And, again, you're fortunate to get to talk to a lot of different people about a lot of different situations. I think every one of them would say that golf has brought out a wide variety of, you know, emotions, attitudes, all the things that make you grow into the type of person hopefully you want to be, because the number one thing they'll tell you about golf is you play golf with somebody, it'll give you a pretty good indication of what they're like.
Yeah.
You know, because it brings the good and the bad out, but it also it can separate you, you know, especially on the business side.
For sure.
So I just think the game of golf has allowed me, and I'm so happy that I took the scholarship offer to Arizona versus, you know, the possibility of playing baseball. I always questioned myself on whether I could have played at the major league level. I think I could have, but I wouldn't take back one, you know, one bogey, one double bogey, one out of bounds, whatever it was. I wouldn't take it for anything.
Okay, last thing for you. I'm going to open up to you now. We're going to put together a fantasy foursome for the scramble that you've got to win. All right, so you're on the team. I'm going to give you wild card picks, the other three players, to make an unbeatable scramble team. I don't care if it's current day tour, legends, LPGA, doesn't matter, champions tour, doesn't matter to me. Who is rounding out Dan Poole's all-time scramble foursome?
Wow.
You guys are going to shoot 36 under some number.
That's crazy. You know, you're going to go between, to me, two guys on the driver, and I'm going to take Greg Norman with his driver because he can play all the shots. He can keep it down. You know, he won in the Turnberry at the conditions.
So you're not taking Dustin Johnson.
No, going
with Greg.
No, I'm going with guys that I knew in my year that I would back against anybody. You know, it wasn't about length. I think he was probably the best, you know, one of the best straight long drivers that we've seen in the game. Can do a lot with a driver. You know, you're going to have to maybe look at, you know, again, I'll pick different guys. I'd go, if you want just pure iron players, you might get Weisskopf, you know, for your mid irons and long iron play, or Payne Stewart. Payne Stewart was notorious for the sweeping full swing that, you know, just was. It was there.
It's a thing of beauty.
Yeah. So, I mean, Tom might get mad and not be as effective as Payne, and I wouldn't play as much with Tom as I did with him. And then, you know, I mean, if I'm not including myself, then you've got to go.
Well, you are, though. You're on the team.
So I'm on the team, and I need three guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you have to almost go with Ben Crenshaw.
Handle the putting.
To handle the putting, you got – and then you had three different styles of putters. You had Norman, who's an aggressive putter. Watson was a great short putt, you know, was an aggressive putter. But I think, you know, you got to go with Ben for just the ability to, you know, just get the job done when he needed it. When he was in his prime, you know, they talk about all these great putters. You got to remember back then, the conditions of the greens weren't as notoriously perfect as they are now. The mowing pattern, you know, the mowing cuts
metal
are a lot
spikes
better.
Everywhere
the rolling, you know, there's great putters now, there's great putters in every era.
Yeah.
But you know, those are guys that I played with that I would be very comfortable saying, okay, you know, match us up. And the only reason you don't put a Jack in there or an Arnie or whatever, they were full service guys. They didn't do one thing any greater than they did the other.
You're not taking the year 2000 version of Tiger?
Well, again, I didn't have a chance to play with him. See, Tiger, in my estimation, was never a great driver of the ball.
True.
I mean,
he can make you a putt in some clutch moments.
Well, he can make you a putt.
Which now he can't do.
Well, and again, he was coming from positions in roughs and stuff. I mean, if you go back with Tiger and you look at where he played from in the World Series at Firestone many, many times.
Yeah.
He made pars and birdies from places that most people aren't. So if you want to hit it into danger,
but not in a scramble, you don't need that in a scramble.
Exactly. We want. I think again, it's a great question. You know, would you throw the Byron Nelsons of the world in there, heck yes.
Yeah.
But if I knew guys of my era that I would be relied upon on number 18 to hit as good a drive as he did on number one, you know, Norman was that guy.
Yeah.
If you needed a 6-iron or a 3-iron or even an 8-iron, high, setting off, you know, soft, clipped off the ground, how could you beat Tom Weisskopf? Mm. I mean, and then, you know, obviously not only from the lag putting standpoint, but also just, you know, making key putts when he needed it, you know, Crenshaw was the guy. Especially if you're playing fast greens. You got to remember, Norman grew up at Royal Melbourne and played extremely well there. Crenshaw, one of the greatest fast putt, you know, fast green putters of all times.
At any point,
I'd be the weak link. I may, if you had a high billowy cut that needed to be put in there,
yeah.
Bill, I'd take care of that. And I would say that probably of all those guys, I might be the best wedge player.
At any point during your thought process to put that team together, was I anywhere in the mix?
Only because I'm looking across, you know, the table from you, and I can honestly say I've seen your swing.
Yeah, I
got to be honest. No, you weren't even close.
I thought maybe beverage cart.
Well,
you know, I could walk up with sandwiches.
Scorekeeper. You know, you'd be a good guy to make sure that we were all on the same page, and you did the scorekeeping right. Because if you made and put a 2 instead of a 3, and we got DQ'd,
could be troubling.
Exactly.
Well, people who are listening to this conversation certainly don't realize that you and I already did a 2-hour radio program together, and here we are 45 minutes later still talking. So thank you for your time and for kind of taking us behind the curtain of a really cool career of a guy who's passionate about this game, who has his name on the sign at a wonderful facility in Mount Pleasant, Michigan. And no matter where you may be listening to this edition of the podcast, you got to get to Pure Michigan and play some golf, and I hope that when you do, you'll come here to see Dan. He's usually in here behind the counter, and lots of memorabilia.
Good chance that you'd see me at some point during the day out here.
Very good. Thanks again.
You bet. My pleasure.
Buckle up. It's time for a Four Golfers Network road trip as we explore and review the top golf destinations on the planet.
It has been a while since we have welcomed in an outside voice in our road trip segment here on the Four Golfers Network podcast. And the last time I saw this guy, we spent more time talking about life than we did playing golf, even though we were on a golf course. So it's kind of fun for me to welcome in my friend Brian Weiss from golftrips.com. He checks in from the mighty Wisconsin Badgerland. How are you, sir?
Hey, wonderful. Good to chat with you again.
Yeah, I haven't seen you in a while. I hear you've lost basically half a person, so I won't recognize you when we see each other in January down south.
Yes, my weight transition is a lot less. I'm hitting the ball about the same, so thank God, it's not a waistline that you're trying to transfer.
Well, you and I have a couple of things in common, one of them being that it's the time of year when in our home states, golf is pretty much winding down, so both of us enjoy getting away to warm weather destinations. So what I'd like to do in the few moments you and I have today is let's give our listeners an idea of maybe those road trips that are still viable before the end of the year. So, you know, it doesn't take away some of the southern part of the Midwest, some of the destinations I know you've visited. Where can we go before December 31st?
Sure. Well, you and I think we initially met in the Biloxi area in Mississippi. And, you know, if you're looking for gaming and casinos and some great golf, that's a fantastic destination. In the middle of the state, which I just got done traveling, some of the courses in there, Dancing Rabbit is in the middle of Mississippi, and that has a casino and gaming as well, along with two great golf courses. And since we're speaking of Mississippi, the number 3 course that opened last year is Mossy Oak, similar to the it's owned by the Camouflage company, which the sister course, Old Waverly, is right next door. And you get two amazing golf courses, completely different in the state of Mississippi. And, just recently been there. The weather is still warm as we are starting to put our long underwear on here in the Midwest.
You know, it's been a couple of years since I've been to Mississippi, but one of the things I enjoyed the most about it was, yeah, the golf is fantastic, but the people are so nice. They just absolutely love to have visitors come in, and it's sort of this surprisingly unexplored, undiscovered golf destination.
you know, the Southern hospitality is alive and well. And if you like grits and seafood, certainly the Biloxi area is fantastic, which we, you know, we don't get good seafood here in the Midwest. I mean, we get it, but it's got to be flown in versus freshly caught.
Yeah, that's true. It's kind of hard to catch shrimp and scallop out of the Great Lakes. You can catch a lot of good things, but the Great Lakes is not one of the places you're going to get your seafood. You know, Brian, I was also thinking about, I know some other places that you've been that have been touched by hurricane damage in the last couple of months, and there's some lingering questions as to whether or not some of those places in North and South Carolina and down into the Panhandle are open for business. And if they're open, what kind of condition they're in? What are you hearing?
Sure. I know the hurricane that hit the Carolinas, Hurricane Florence, you know, the Myrtle Beach, as I went onto their website last night in preparation for this, most of the courses were open mid-September, with a few of them late September and some just recently opened. I think conditions are alive and well. I went out to the websites, and more importantly, I checked their Facebook posts, because that's usually where the fresh pictures are. And I think things are alive and well in the Brunswick Islands, Myrtle Beach, Grand Strand area. One of the harder hit areas is the Panhandle of Florida. Thankfully, the hardest hit, I believe, was Mexico Beach. I know there are some course closings in the Panama City area, but destinations like Destin and the Gulf Shores of Alabama were not hit as hard, and there is amazing golf being played there today, as you know, temperatures are in the 30s and 40s here in Milwaukee.
You know, I've always found it amazing how well courses can rebound from, I think, catastrophe. We look at the Greenbrier, that entire course was submerged, the entire region was submerged. Or you can look at some other area, like New Orleans was hit. And yeah, it takes a little bit of time, but with a whole lot of hard work, they're able to bring it all back together. I think probably the biggest question mark for golfers looking for a road trip is, how do they really know for sure if the quality of the course is going to be, you know, what they dreamed it would be?
Sure. I think probably two things: contacting the Convention and Visitors Bureau in that area. There are enough great websites that do reviews, whether it's some of the travel sites or the golf travel sites, you know, and try to find those fresh reviews on conditions. You know, sometimes convention and visitors bureaus will put the rosy picture on things, yeah. But I think going to those review websites are probably the best, or to contact the courses directly and, you know, ask them how the conditions are and, you know, if maybe they're might need a longer period for recovery. But for the most part, you know, there's not a lot of building damage on golf courses, because it's usually a clubhouse and a starter shack or a snack shack, so they can get the infrastructure, you know, back together pretty quickly.
We are privileged to partner with a lot of convention and visitors bureaus in what we do for our television show. So I say this cautiously, they will probably not be your best source for an honest assessment of what conditions are like, because they want you to come visit the area regardless. So I like your idea of going to the review sites. And I know that at golftrips.com, you're busy keeping track of all this kind of stuff too. What else will people find on your website as we try to put together some end of the year road trips?
Yeah, Golf Trips and Golf Packages, the two umbrella websites that we run, have destination review type submissions, as well as the latest golf packages. So, you know, if you're looking if you know what destination you have in mind, there's golf packages right there. Our websites are also really good on researching what destination you may want to go to if you're undecided.
Well, it is going to be soon. It's going to be that time when we need to get out of the country. So the next time you and I gather, let's talk about some international destinations that would provide that warm weather escape. I just got back from a really cool one in Mexico, and I know you've traveled the world as well. So how about we schedule that for our next segment?
Sure, that would be great. Maybe we need to travel before that, but yeah. If not, we certainly have enough experiences that we can chat about for some warm weather international destinations.
Even better yet, why don't we just go there?
We should do a live show, and I'm gonna have to chat with my wife on that because we have some busy travel coming up ahead. But I like your thinking.
If you need any help with the convincing process, just let me know, or she can come along. I'll bring my wife along, and we'll just go somewhere warm. That's the way to do it.
Golf and spouses. Why didn't I think of that?
All right, man. Thanks so much. We'll see you later. Have a great holiday if I don't talk to you before.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Bill.
Thanks so much to both Dan Pohl and Brian Weiss for being our featured guests on this edition of the Four Golfers Network podcast. I do hope you'll share the link and consider going into iTunes and giving us a 5-star rating as we continue celebrating the greatest game on earth. And we've got a huge, cool surprise coming for you next week as we take a road trip to Jamaica Mon for the Jamaica Pro-Am. And we're about to launch... Should I say it? Yeah, sure. We're about to launch our Roku channel filled with all sorts of video content. More on that coming up in the weeks ahead. Until then, I'm Bill Hobson, hoping you hit everything right down the middle.
If you're enjoying this episode of the Four Golfers Network, be sure to check out our other podcasts, The Big Impact, celebrating inspiring people and their stories. You can find all of the podcasts from Hobson Digital in iTunes, Google Play, or online at hobsonmedia.com.